อ้าปาก
You'd have had to have been there, I tell you. My name is John Scott, and I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober. I've been sober since December 19th, 1982, and for that I'm awful grateful. God, you guys got sicker than others around here, I'll tell you what. I would love to tell you a little story that I heard while I was trying to swallow some food tonight. Bad. It's a bad deal. I haven't thrown up like that since I was drinking, I don't think. But I want to thank the committee and Dave and Susan for asking us to celebrate with you your birthday. I mean, this is a big deal. We have a group. You folks could come to Montana and sit in our meeting and feel just absolutely at home. I'm not kidding you. I mean, right down to the morning of the birthday celebration that we have, we even have the same stinking casserole. And we all eat it. We just pig out on it, you know. And we just do the same thing you guys. We talk a little AA, eat a lot, talk a little AA, eat a lot, you know, and take a lot of other people's inventory and eat a lot, you know. And it's just, I feel at home. I really do. I mean, since the minute I was supposed to be picked up at the airport, I mean, we're sitting there, you know, it's supposed to be now, isn't it? You know, somebody didn't show. It was probably absolutely Vicky's husband's fault, Mike. Mike's married to an Al-Anon like mine, you know it's his fault. So, you guys have been great. I really felt warmly welcomed, and I just, it feels like home. It feels like Alcoholics Anonymous. It feels like people who are interested in their own sobriety and the people around them. And it feels like, It's what I always was wanting, man. I never could quite get there, you know. I drank with a lot of people and did a lot of things trying to get this very thing that I almost passed up. Alcoholics Anonymous is the most single important event in my entire life, bar none. And there are days, because I'm a real alcoholic, that I think I have certainly overcorrected. And there's no need for me to go to any more of those stinking meetings and talk to people who really are not concerned about their well-being. And I get into these self-pity things. And what happens to me is every once in a while, I have somebody from my home group goes out and gets drunk and kills himself. And that just all of a sudden brings me right back to reality. We're in the grips of a progressive illness that never gets better. It always gets worse. And the only thing that's going to save people like David and Mike and myself, Todd and everybody else around here, is a planned program of action outlined in the first 164 pages of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the only thing I know of. I mean, any treatment center you go to in the country today, they're going to point you back to us, you know, charge you $12,000, $13,000, give you a big book and say, now go to AA. You know, I mean, that's what has to happen for people like us. And I don't know of any other recovery program that even comes close to this. I don't know of any other that even touches what we can do here. And yet we're not all that successful when you really stick around for a while and you look at what's going on. I had a sponsor, his name was Richard, and Richard always used to say, I mean, I would come out of a meeting just crying because I was so grateful that I'd finally gotten some kind of peace in my mind, and I'd say, God, that was a great meeting tonight, Richard. And he'd say, yeah, John, it really was, and it's really too bad that most of those people in that room will die drunk. Jeez, what an old fogey. He's been here way, way too long. You know, his mind's warped, you know. And I tell you what, I don't think he's too far off. Truth of the matter is, most of us, our mind takes us over sooner or later. We get mad at our group or our sponsor, the people that we're working with. And, you know, it's Alcoholics Anonymous, let's face it, is very inconvenient if you're building empires. And so what has to happen is, I think somewhere along the line, instead of being around Alcoholics Anonymous, we have to get into Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's a big difference. I mean, I know of a lot of people who have been around. We have visitors in here all the time. But there's very few people that I know of who really get committed to the ideals and the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 steps, the 12 traditions, and the 12 concepts, to the point where they begin to live this way of life. You know, I thought that my problem was drinking. Most people who come to Alcoholics Anonymous think it is too. But I think that my real problem is living life sober. I don't fight drinking. I do it really well. I can't stand sobriety. Sobriety makes me sick. You know, she gets really weird. And those kids that I have get stranger. And sooner or later, I get cut off in traffic like Clancy talks about and all kinds of, and the next thing you know, I'm just nuts. And give me a couple of drinks, and all of a sudden, it's like, oh. It's like, I'm human again. It's like, thank God. Thank God I can drink. And from time to time, people would say, you drink too much. And I'd go, you don't understand what you're talking about. I don't drink too much. I have stress in my life. I have pressure in my life. I have a goofy wife and crazy kids in my life. You know, I have a family that can't stand me and I can't stand them. You know, and I hate my job and I hate you. And what I want to do, what I want to do is I want to get out of here so I can go have a drink or two so I can relax. And I had to get beat into a state of reasonableness. You know, I said my sobriety date was December 19th, 1982, and the day that I really need to remember is the day before. I woke up in the basement of a house. I did not have any money left in my billfold. I did not know where I had been for the last several days. I'm a blackout drinker. I like to drink on the run. I mean, I get to drinking, and the next thing you know, I run out of money or something happens. And I find myself in this basement with this guy, I mean, I had gone through a series of crap happening in my life. I mean, she was weirder than most years. And my dad told me that if I didn't straighten up right now, I was fired. And that's pretty bad when you get fired from your own family business, you know. And I was down to two friends, and one of them was on the payroll, so you know what kind of friend he was. You know, and the thing was is that I found myself in this basement one morning, and it's like I didn't plan on getting sober then. I had tried to quit drinking before. I run a ranch, a farm. We at that time I think that year we cut 27,000 acres of winter wheat, and we had all these combine crews going and stuff, and I kind of missed it. I was on a runner, and I remember coming back for the party though. You know, what we had was we had this great big old water trough full of ice and beer and whiskey and all that good stuff, you know, and I had sworn off that morning. I was never, ever, ever going to drink again. And that night I lucked out because we had a fire, and several of us people went and fought the fire while the rest of the people stayed at the party. And I got back that night, and I remember giving my booze away to my employees. I had about 75 crazy, insane alcoholic employees. You don't hire Al-Anons, they make you look bad, you know. You want these drunks to kind of, you know, and I had all these drunks that was working for me, and what I did is I offered them all my booze, and I gave them, you know, this one I gave, you know, several six packs of beer, and this one I gave a fifth of whiskey. And we had this trailer court down the, not too far from the headquarters, and I would go down to that trailer court in about 3 days because I no longer wanted to quit drinking. And I knock on your door and I say, I want my booze back. And that's the longest I ever remember staying sober, because what would happen is those people would else give me the booze that I gave to them, or else I'd stay there until we drank it, you know. And I got just commode hugging drunk that time again, you know. But whenever I got to come to in this basement of this house this day, I thought, you know, I'm going to have to quit. This is it. I've just got to quit. I've got to quit drinking. And I decided that I was going to go visit a friend of mine. His name was Frank. Now, Frank had been over to my house several months earlier. And Frank was a feed salesman and sold animal health products. And I knew that he had been in Alcoholics Anonymous, because about 6 months earlier, he was over at my house, and I was really glad to see him. It was about noon, and I was already drinking, and I asked Frank, you know, come on in and have a drink. He says, no, thank you, I'm not drinking today. And that was really strange, because Frank drank really well, just like I did. And Cindy was gone, because at that time, Cindy was working three jobs. She's an Al-Anon. And what was happening in Billings, Montana at that time is there was a depression going on. And I was drinking at a place called the Keg Bar. I had reduced myself to this little place. It's where bikers and truck drivers and ne'er-do-wells go. And all my buddies at the Keg Bar couldn't find a job. They'd been looking for a job for a long, long time. And Cindy and I got mad one night. She decided she's going to go to work. And I laughed. I said, go to work? Yeah, that'd be great. I've got friends in the Keg that haven't worked in years. And now you're going to run into town and get yourself a job. And I just laughed at her. She went into town, got three jobs that same day, and went to work on all three of them. You know, so, you know, never underestimate an Al-Anon. And anyway, the thing is that I'm thinking about this Frank, and he had been out to the ranch, and he came in that day, and Cindy was working, and I offered him a drink, and he wouldn't take it. And we sat and we visited for a long time because I was being persecuted because Cindy wasn't treating me right and other people in the world weren't treating me right. And Frank and I were good. We would just bleed all over. You know, we'd get drunk and just bleed all over, talk about how bad we got it. And he wouldn't drink. I mean, he would not drink. And I'm an obnoxious drunk. You know, I mean, if you won't play with me, then I'll get drunk and I'll play with you. I mean, something's going to happen whenever I'm drinking. And he was down in the basement where my bar was, and he would try to literally leave. And he'd just get up about those stairs about halfway, and I'd just grab his hind leg and just pull him back down, you know, sit him on the stool and say, sit down, we're not through talking yet, you know. And he was a good enough friend, he'd let me get away with that stuff. And I kept saying, why don't you have a drink, Frank? He says, because I quit for today. I'm not going to have another drink. Not today, anyway. And anyway, somewhere along the line, I pulled it out of him where he was going to go later on that night because he couldn't have a drink. He was going to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was devastated. I couldn't believe it. Here's my best drinking buddy as he's going to AA. I said, my God, Frank, what the heck are you doing going to AA? I said, you drink just like I do. He says, yeah, I know. I said, Frank, come on now. I mean, this is something serious. I mean, you can't, you know, I thought in Alcoholics Anonymous, what they did was they taught you how to drink. And he says, no, we don't drink in AA. And that's why I'm not going to have a drink with you today. I said, man, I'll tell you what, that sounds like a real overcorrection on your part, Frank. But, you know. And then I got to thinking, I mean, my life is absolutely upside down. And I said, Frank, you know, I'll tell you what, I've been thinking a little bit. I think I'd like to go with you. And he says, oh, no. You can't go with me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, well, why not, Frank? He says, John, because Alcoholics Anonymous is for people who want to quit drinking, and you're still drinking, obviously. And he says, when you decide you want to quit, you know, give me a call and I'll take you to a meeting. And I remember later on that afternoon he took off. No, Cindy came home. Now, Cindy was wonderful at these days. I mean, you know, she's really nice last night, but I'm going to tell you, when I was living with her and drinking, she was insane crazy. And what she used to do is, whenever I had my friends over, she'd just open the door and walk off, you know. And then my bar was downstairs, and that's where I spent most of my time. There's a tile floor up above where the kitchen was, and she'd get this vacuum cleaner out and just... and just right over the top of the roof, you know. And if that wasn't enough, if she wasn't smoking us out that way, she'd come down each one of those stairs and vacuum it, you know, just right by the bar. We had neighbors that come over, and it was, you know, like 2 o'clock in the morning, and she's got four loads of washers, you know, the wash vacuuming, just going in. And the one neighbor says, you know, she's really busy, ain't she? but anyway, when Cindy came home, that was Frank's signal to leave because he'd been there all through that stuff many times, and he wasn't gonna stay. It was always really a wonderful deal whenever Cindy come home. And I mean, everything changed. The whole, it's like a black cloud just walked in, you know. And anyway, I was laying there in this basement on the 18th of December, and I was thinking about this deal about Frank. I knew Frank had gone to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I finally got my bearings straight, and I had been drinking with a guy who was about 75, 80 years old. And I told him, I says, you know, I think I got to do something about my drinking because I don't think I can live this way much longer. I mean, I've been trying to kill myself on a real regular basis. I stick a gun in my mouth and I think about pulling the trigger, you know. Sometimes I pull the trigger and then I think next time I'm going to put a bullet in it, you know. And I hated my wife. I really did. I'd been seeing this attorney trying to get my law, my divorce papers in line because, you know, she was crazy. And he told me, he says, John, he says, with your track record, there's no way in the world you can keep those kids of yours. Those kids will go to her. And you know, I never liked my kids. I never liked them hardly at all. And I found out that I couldn't have them, and all of a sudden those kids just got to be special to me, you know? And I mean that's kind of the way I am with everything. And it's like if I can't have it, it's like I got to have it. If I got it, it's like I don't want it, you know? And I can remember that happening, and I thought, you know, maybe one of the things I can do, now in case of somebody here who's just come to Alcoholics Anonymous and they're not thinking that their reasons for being here are pure, I want to tell you about my pure reasons to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now don't forget, I have the mind of a newcomer. You know, every 45 seconds it's a new idea, you know. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, they told me that I was afraid, and I said, I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid of nothing. I'm not afraid of you or nobody else. But I really was. I was terrified, you know. I was afraid that Alcoholics Anonymous wouldn't work for a guy like me. And then I got terrified that it would. You know, do you realize what will happen to you if you're new here tonight and Alcoholics Anonymous works for you? You won't have to drink again. If you don't drink again, your head will probably fall off. You know? I mean, that's what I thought. And then I got to thinking about, my God, will she ever come back? I mean, will I ever have a family again? And then it dawned on me, what happens if she does? You know? That scared me even worse. You know? So I can remember thinking, you know, my God, I got to do something about this drinking. And me and this old, his name was Johnny, me and him decided we were going to go visit Frank. And we went over to the feed store, and Frank was over there, and I walked in. I says, Frank, I got to do something about my drinking. It was about 8 o'clock in the morning, and I'm nervous when I'm drinking like I was talking about drinking. You know, I'm waking up in the middle of this, you know, in the basement, and just my head's just, you know, and I always drank as much as I could every chance I got. And on the way down to Frank's, we picked up some beer because I get real nervous in the morning like that. And if I have a few beers, I can calm down. And I could remember going into Frank's, and I already had about 2 or 3 beers. And I told Frank, I said, Frank, I think I'd like to really go with you to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous if you'd take me tonight. And he said, oh, he was just tickled to see me, you know. And I told him about Johnny, who was out in the car. And he said, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. He says, you guys slip out there. I'm going to get out of here just for a second. He says, I'll come out and visit with you. And he come out there. And he had these cards, these cards with the 21 questions on them, you know, the one that nobody can pass. You know, there's no way in the world you can pass it. You know, I can't remember what the questions are, but they're all loaded. Now, Al-Anons can pass it, but they have a way to do that. But I could never pass it. And I find myself, Frank was handing these cards out there. I mean, it was obvious. I have this secret weapon laid between my ears, and I just know things. I know things that are true or not true. It doesn't matter because once I click in, it's solid. I know it's true. And I knew one of the things that's true is with a name like Alcoholics Anonymous, your membership is dropping. It has to be. You know, and here you got, somebody paid a lot of money for this thing, because there's no way in the world anybody can pass this test, and this is how you get those new dummies in there. And, if, you know, the deal is, I know the deal. About a month or two, you get them hooked in there, and you're going to have to pay, you know, $100, $150 a month for the rest of your life, just because you're going to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's how you keep all those paid counselors that go to all your meetings. You know, these are things that I knew just like that, you know. All Frank was glad to see us. He was all teary-eyed and everything. He's so glad, you know. He said, man, we've been praying for you and all this stuff. And I said, yeah, Frank, you know. And Johnny and I are popping another beer. And he says, well, when do you want to go to a meeting? I said, well, let's go tonight. You got a meeting tonight? He says, oh, yeah, we got a meeting tonight. I said, well, let's go tonight. Oh, no. He says, you can't come. I said, why not? I said, well, Alcoholics Anonymous is for people who quit drinking. And obviously, you and Johnny have not quit. And I said, well, what's it going to take to get into AA? He says, you're going to have to quit drinking. And I says, well, when do I have to quit? He says, well, quit tomorrow. He says, you're drinking today, but if you quit tomorrow, he says, I'll tell you what, tomorrow night I'll take you to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. But he says, you're drinking now, so go ahead and drink all day long. Drink as much as you can. Just have as much fun as you can stand. You know? So I went over to the keg bar. Keg bar at 8:30 in the morning. Nobody in that bar at 8:30 in the morning could pass the 21 questions, or the 20 questions. Nobody. Just absolutely proved my theory. You know, even the bartender couldn't pass it. I couldn't believe it, you know. We talked about it, and about half the people sitting at the bar, there's only about 3 of them, half of those people at the bar, they'd already been to AA, so it didn't work, you know. And I remember having to call Cindy that morning because what I'd done is I promised her like I had so many other times that I would be good, and she had a party that night that she was working at one of these jobs she was working. I was at a bank, and it was Christmas time. It was the 18th of December, and they was having a Christmas party that night, and I had told her I would be sober by that time, and somewhere along the line I had called her, and I remember calling her. It was about noon or so, and I knew I wasn't going to be sober, and I told her that I wasn't going to be sober, and she was elated. You know, you could just. She used to say, "I don't care what's going on. Just call me. Just let me know where you're at." You did that once or twice, and that's about it. You know. But anyway, I called her and I told her. I says, "You know, I'm not going to make it. I mean, I'm not going to be in any shape by tonight to be at a party of yours." I said, "I'm just not going to make it. But I tell you what I am going to do. I'm going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous now." And she says, "Well, good for you." Click. You know, she was elated. And I remember that next morning when I woke up, I found myself, like I always found myself, you know, I just wake up and just terror. You know, I always woke up in terror. I always woke up trying to figure out what it was that I just did. Because it seems like I always just did something. And I can remember... the phone was ringing, and it was Frank calling Cindy, telling Cindy, "Don't let him drink." And I remember Cindy saying, she had a long time ago quit worrying about me drinking or not drinking. And she told him that she was not interested in whether I drank or whether I didn't drink. She was not concerned. And anyway, Frank got a hold of me. He told me not to drink, and I told him I wouldn't. And for some reason, I didn't drink that day. And I went to that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that night, and they had me come over early. And there's a little restaurant across the street. And Frank says, "I want you to meet a guy. He's my sponsor. His name is Richard. And Richard was a guy who wore a three-piece suit and just smoked cigarettes, just like it's just gone, you know." And Richard was a little nervous. And he was a car salesman for General Motors. Or actually, he up the ladder further than that. And he was very successful. But he had been sober for about 5 years, gone out and got drunk, and now he'd been sober for about five more years. And he would ask me strange questions. He says, I remember the first question he ever asked me. This is the first time I ever met this guy. He says, do you believe that you're responsible for your own actions? And you know, I knew this was an elite group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been trying to get into it for quite some time. And I can remember thinking, you know, in my head, I can remember thinking, what's the right answer, what's the right answer? And I knew that he'd been talking to Richard, or Frank, who'd been talking to Cindy. And I always had a conspiracy going on. There's always a conspiracy of some kind going on in the background. That's why I always carried a gun with me. You know, I don't want you to think I was illegal. I had a gun permit. You know, I convinced the judge that they was about to get me. You know, and if you're an alcoholic, you know who they are. You never really saw them, but they're just right out there, just right beyond your sight, you know. And one of my big deals was whether or not to wear a gun to the Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I figured they wouldn't even be that sick to go to AA, so I left it at home. But I can remember him asking me this question, if I felt like I was responsible for my own actions. And I finally told him, yeah, I thought I was. And he says, good, maybe now you'll start acting like it. And I thought, my God. How can this guy act like this? I mean, he don't even know who I am. But he knew who I was because he sat down for about the next hour and a half and told me his story, which is almost exactly like my story. There's just a few changes. But he didn't tell me about the crazy things he did so much as the things that happened inside. He told me about hating himself to the point he was willing to kill himself because he couldn't stand himself anymore. He talked about being a loser beyond his own comprehension. He talked about not being able to be a man among men and not being able to be able to do the simple things that everybody else can do. And he knows he can't do it because tomorrow he's going to have another drink. And that was me. I understood that. I heard that loud and clear. And I went to that first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that night, and I haven't had a drink since. Now, that doesn't mean anything. It just means I haven't had a drink since. Doesn't mean that, you know, it's like I used to say, I have not had a drink this time anymore, you know, because the reason is I don't know. I don't know why some people come get sober and some people leave. I have no idea in the world. I think that after you've been here for a while, I think there's all kinds of reasons that people stay and leave. And that's because somewhere along the line, we don't give the gift away. You've got to give the thing away to keep it. I've been sober for about a year. I quit going to AA. And Richard didn't call me to see how I was doing. You know, he waited. He understood the nature of the illness. You know, he believed in two things, booze and pain. You know, and the booze got me first, then the booze got me first. If the pain got me first, that's all the better. And I went out there and I was doing it all by myself. Thank you very much. I'm going to, you know, well, heck, after you're sober for 6 months, I mean, come on, this is kind of overcorrection, you know. And I went out there and like I said, my problem is not drinking. It's living life sober. It's sobriety. And here I am sober after 6 months and I'm just absolutely insane, but not going to meetings because I don't need them. Of course, I got a little strange. You know, Cindy got weird. Cindy used to say, my God, John, you're not going to go to another meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. This started at about 3 months of sobriety. And I'd say, yeah, I am. And she'd say, when do I get mine? You know, when are you going to start being a father and a husband? When are you going to start doing what you were supposed to do? You know, and I'd go tell my sponsor, Richard, about that. And he'd say, well, she gets to talk like that all you want to, but what you want to do tomorrow night when the meeting starts, you be here. And he just continually kept me there. And after about 6 months or so, I found myself, kind of going with Cindy because I was overcorrecting. I was drinking, I wasn't drinking that bad. I'd been sober for about six months. Life was good. You know, why would I want to go to meetings? I quit going to meetings for about 2 weeks. Cindy started saying, don't you think you need to go to a meeting again? You know, and finally I got to where I was about ready to drink and it come down to making a phone call or drinking, and I made the phone call and I talked to Richard about it, and geez, he jumped in the middle. I thought he'd be glad to hear from me. And he got in the middle of me and he says, you got 30 minutes to get to town. Well, it took me about 35, but I drove fast. And I got into town and he told me to get a cup of coffee and sit down over there, and he started explaining to me about how big of a thief I was, about how I'd come in here and stole all this good stuff, and now because I'm not willing to give any of it away, I can't keep it. And somehow I began to understand that what he was telling me was true, because I thought that I could keep this thing. I thought that once I got sober that I'd be able to just stay sober on my own. And that's not how this deal works. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with a bad attitude. I had some good old-timers in my group whenever I first showed up. There's a guy named Rotten Ralph. He was an attorney. Rotten Ralph's favorite deal was to just try to be like sandpaper for newcomers. Just anything to just get them crazy. And then he'd, at the end of his little talk, he'd say, oh, and here's a dollar in case I made anybody thirsty. I want to be the first one to buy you a drink, you know. He was really kind to newcomers. And then there's this guy named Nick. Nick was a little short guy. And Nick used to always, tell newcomers, you know, your name's not worth remembering. You're not going to be here for more than 6 months. He says, so why would I want to remember your name? You know, and what he didn't know is he was making me so mad. I was going to make sure I was going to be there for 6 months because he's going to learn my damn name. You know, but he didn't know that. You know, then there was this guy named Gerald. And Gerald, I'd walk in and he'd ask me how I was doing, and I'd say, fine. You know, I said, how are you doing, really? Oh, I hate everything. I hate her. I hate God. I hate you. You know, and he got on me one night about that, and he was. Really a rude person. He says, I'll tell you what you're going to do. He says, I don't care what you do with these other people, but he says, I'll tell you what you're going to do with me from now on. He says, when I walk up to you, I'm going to reach my hand out, and I'm going to shake your hand, and I'm going to say, John, how are you doing? And you're going to say, why, Joe, I'm getting better in every way, every day. Thank you very much. And I hated you guys. I just, you know... You didn't understand. I was living with a crazy woman to begin with, you know, and now I got to live with crazy people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got this newcomer mind that's just crazy, just going nuts all the time. I can remember one night thinking, by God, I'm going to make that Nick remember my name. So I went up to Nick and I had a little tear in my eye and I started to tell him about my sad story of woe, about how my wife is crazy and insane and she was trying to kill me, come out of closets with baseball bats and all this kind of stuff. I thought I'd get him, you know. And he started to work. You could kind of see him give a little bit. And if you're new and if you tried to work an old timer, you've seen that happen. You just know that he's going to go with you. And I thought he went with me, but he didn't. He turned on me. He says, listen, goddammit. He says, so you're an alcoholic. He says, now what the hell are you going to do about it? And there's people in the room. I mean, I wasn't alone, and it's like, I can't stand public humiliation. It just drives me crazy. And I decide, all right, that's it, I'm leaving. So I grabbed my coat, and I was going to walk out the door. And what happens in this meeting place is you had to go around the kind of a hallway, and there's a refrigerator there. And whenever I come around the hallway, here Nick was, and he just kind of gave me that old three-finger push up against that refrigerator, and says, all right, John, so I'm going to tell you something. He says, why don't you just get the hell out of here? He says, you're wasting your time, you're wasting my time, and you're damn sure wasting their time. Just get the hell out of here and drink. That's what you want to do, drink. And old Ralph is right over his shoulder with his dollar, says, yeah, let me buy you a first drink. Hey, let me buy you a first drink. There's no way to treat a newcomer, I'll tell you. You know, I had bought a used car from my used car salesman sponsor. It was a diesel, and I spun gravel out. Well, I tried to spin gravel out in that parking lot that night. You know, I'd gotten that pickup or that car of mine. I turned it on. Of course, you got to let the glow light come on, ding, ding. You know, get it turned on. I'm just smoking, you know. I get it running. I floorboard it and just, I'm going out to the ranch. Top of my lungs, I'm screaming, I'm cussing God, I'm cussing AA, I'm cussing my wife, I'm cussing everybody I can think of. I'm driving this diesel as fast as I can, you know, just beating on the dash, honking the horn, just insane crazy. And it dawns on me about three quarters of the way out. So I'm an alcoholic. What am I going to do about it? You know, just hit me like a ton of bricks. Just hit me like a ton of bricks. What am I going to do about it? How do I want to live the rest of my life? Do I want to live the lie, or do you want to start doing something about my problem? You know, and I find myself a few days later going back into town, you know, to another meeting, same goofy people there, you know, Nick, Rotten Ralph, Frank, Gerald. How you doing, Gerald? Getting better in every way. Thank you very much. You know? And it hit me like a ton of bricks. I was. Tears started rolling down my eyes. I got so grateful I couldn't hardly stand it until I got to the meeting, and then somebody, you know. If you're new to AA and you feel like you've been offended here, welcome. I mean, shoot, that's, you know. I don't know. I guess the way you get sensitive and insecure people over being sensitive and insecure is you just trip them a lot or something. That's what they seem like they did to me. I don't remember anybody being too awful kind to me. I really don't. It's like when they was kind to me, I was like nervous because I was waiting for the shoe to fall. It seems like, and I had this sponsor for 45 days before he had been sober for 7 years, and he asked me. He told me he was going to be a sponsor, and he went out and got drunk after about 45 days, and I was kind of resentful about that anyway because I hadn't got to ask my. I was appointed, you know, that night. They said, "This is your guy," and. So I'd heard about this guy drinking. I thought, you know, there's a little blonde in there. I've been really kind of eyeing, and you know, she wasn't any good anymore. She's crazy, and I didn't want nothing to do with her. But this little blonde, I thought, well, my God, I could ask her to be my sponsor. And I can remember going in there. I can remember going in there that night, and I was walking across the room. I was going right far, and this Richard intercepted me, you know, and he says. Oh, he says, John, by the way, he says, your sponsor went out and got drunk. I says, yeah, that's what I heard. He says, well, I'm going to be your sponsor now. I said, well, no, wait a minute. I didn't ask you to be my... Oh, he says, you don't have to. He says, I'm going to be your sponsor. And he says, because I know what you want. And for some strange reason, he did know what I wanted, although every time he told me what I wanted, it's really not what I wanted. But when I did what he asked me to do, I began to get the things that I always wanted. And that seems to be the story of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I give up on having it my way, I start to get the things that I always wanted. I really do. I mean, I will bet you $1,000 that what you guys are offering me is not what I really want. You know, I don't want to be accountable. I don't want to be responsible. These words scared me to death. I mean, accountability. Ah! You know, responsibility. No way. No thank you, you know. Commitment. You know, not more than 45 seconds. Thank you very much. And these are the things, these are the words, the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous that begin to turn my life, that begin to give me the things that I was missing. And yet, all the time, right up in even today, sometimes I'll go, yeah, but you don't, I mean, I've done enough. This is it. I mean, I was doing that 4 days in here, you know, and I'm still doing it. I think it's part of the disease. The book talks about our problems are centered in our mind. And I have to somehow, like I was talking this afternoon, I have to somehow bring it from here to here that that this is out to kill me. My mind thinks it can kill me and live, you know, and I have to somehow begin to understand that I really don't understand. And once I begin to get that just a little bit, then I'm on my way. And that has to happen for a guy like me. And I have to have people in my life like I just described. Those people literally saved my life. I was so sick. Those goofballs saved my life. If I'd have been that much weller, how do you do that? How do you take that kind of humiliation? And yet every one of those guys I knew, there was never ever a doubt in my mind that those people weren't really truly concerned about my well-being. There never was a time that I did not, I just knew it, even though they wouldn't put up with my stuff. I was a spoiled brat when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a spoiled brat. Richard started sponsoring me, and he told me, he says, how you get along with your wife? Well, I knew he knew. He'd been talking to Frank. Frank always ratted on me, you know. And I said, well, I'm getting a divorce. He says, wait a minute. He says, now, did I hear this right? Did you say you was getting a divorce? Yeah, I spent a lot of money on it already. He says, you'll quit that right now. I said, well, wait a minute. You don't understand. She's crazy. She's crazy as a loon. I mean, she'd drive me home at night and turn the car off and tiptoe into the house. It'd be 40 below outside, and I'm sitting there freezing. I could have been killed several times. He says, of course she's crazy. She's got to be crazy. Anybody live with you for 13 years got to be out of her stinking mind. He says, but we're going to, right now we got the two of you confined. We're not going to let you separate. If we can keep the two of you together, there might be a slight chance that humanity might be better off later on. And so what happened is he started to tell me, he says, you may or may not get a divorce, but we're not going to do anything for a year, all right? He says, but what we're going to do for this next year, what we're going to do is you're going to start treating her like you love her. Now, I knew I had him. Because this is a rigorous honesty program, and now he's making me lie right off the bat. And he wouldn't put up with that. He just says, shut up. Just do what I'm telling you to do. And he says, I'll tell you what you're going to do. He says, you're going to go home tonight, and you're going to treat her kindly. He says, you're going to tell her you love her, but because you and I both know you're a liar, you're going to show her you love her. And my ears went up, and he says, no, that ain't what I'm talking about. He says, for you, it's going to be something really spiritual. He says, you're going to have to pick up your dirty clothes. You're going to have to make up a bed. He says, you might have to take her out to eat. You might have to buy a card, some flowers. He says, you're going to do things that make her feel special and important. And he says, and you will never tear her down in public or in private. He says, you always build her up. He says, if you do that, He says, I'm going to tell you, and my mind is going, ain't no way, hate it, no. I mean, we fought. I mean, we loved each other like you couldn't believe until alcoholism got a hold of us. And it's like we just hated each other. I mean, we went, and we loved to hate each other. I mean, it's crazy stuff, you know. And it's like, I'd drive her out in the car in the middle of the night out on this ranch, and she'd get lost in about 45 seconds, you know. And I'm out there, and I'm going to chop you up into little tiny pieces. It was really love, you know, just deep. And they'll never find you, you know, and they'll never know who really did it and all this crazy and fun stuff. Of course, I've been telling everybody that I knew for the last year I was going to kill her, you know. She'd come up missing. I think it'd probably look this way, but I told Richard, I just can't do it. He says, wait a minute, I'll give you a carrot. He says, if you listen to me, I'll give you a carrot. If you do this, and you do this right, it will drive her crazy. All right, I'll do it. Went home that night, she come up to me, you're a dirty, rotten SOB. And I said, yeah, that's not all. Here's some more stuff, you know. And I just done a little inventory, and I started rattling it off to her, and she's just blank. I mean, she don't know what to do with it. She turns around, and you can just tell. And I go, got it. and little by little, things started to change. You know, I got to the point where I noticed something in her. She was getting better. And she wasn't even hardly going to a meeting at all. But she was getting better. She wasn't not so hard to live with anymore. And the reason that she was not so hard to live with anymore is because really she wasn't the one that was changing, I was the one that was changing. And the trouble with Alcoholics Anonymous, it works too fast for people like me. Because it wasn't very long, like I said, 6 months, I'm already thinking about how do I get out of here. The very thing that's given me everything I ever wanted, I'm trying to get rid of it. Because I know it's not what I want. And all I have to do is listen to this. That's all I have to do. That's all I have to do today is start listening to this. And that's what makes it so devastating for people that we work with. I mean, I work with a lot of guys. I sponsor a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, they save my life over and over again. My sponsor helps. I mean, my sponsors have always been just phenomenal. I have, like Cindy was talking last night, standing on the shoulders of giants. I'm standing on some giants. I truly am. And but the people that I sponsor, the people that I work with, they're the people that are on a daily just grind with me. I mean, we're in the trenches. We're doing the deal. And after I was sober for about 11 years, my sister had this store, and it was going downhill really, really fast. And one way or another, I ended up managing it. And I had called her and told her that tomorrow I'm going to take you out to eat supper or eat lunch, because she was really depressed. She's not like one of us. I mean, we go into the doctor and it's like, what symptoms do you want so I can get that? You know, it's just not the way she was. She's really truly depressed, and she'd not been doing well at all, and she needed a break, and I was going to give her a break that next day. In the meantime, I had begun to sponsor a guy. This was 11 years of sobriety. I began to sponsor a guy who was had a lot of money. I mean, he spent his summers or his winters down in Central America, and he'd been sober for 10 years, been drinking for 5 years, and just now had got sober again. And I've been sponsoring him for about 2 or 3 weeks, and he called me up that morning, and he says, John, I'm going to fire you as a sponsor because I don't like what you guys are doing, because you're doing too much. And he was really persuasive. I mean, he told me why. And I'm sitting there listening to him, and I think, yeah, this guy is, I mean, he's hitting all cylinders, you know. I hung up the phone and I got to thinking about it. And later on that afternoon, I went and picked up my sister because I told her I'd take her out to eat. And I was telling her, you know, Maggie, I've been thinking about this deal, about this me going to AA and drinking and all this. I don't think I was really that bad. When you really stop and consider, you know, the insanity that Cindy and I was in at the time and this and that. I mean, you know, come on, who wouldn't drink? And she hadn't laughed in months, and all of a sudden she just started, you could just see it just start building. And she started laughing, and she started laughing, and she started kicking and screaming and hollering and laughing. And she started yelling at me to get to the phone station so she could run into the toilet, you know, and she's just losing it, you know. And she goes, I pull over, she runs in there, she comes back out, she's still bent over laughing. I said, what the hell's so funny? And she says, you don't remember, do you? And I said, remember what? She says, you never draw a sober breath. Last 4 years you drank, or last 3 years you drank. I said, well, what are you talking about? She says, you don't remember. You don't remember how insane crazy you truly was, do you? I said, oh, well, if that's the case, I guess I'll go to another meeting tonight. I mean, that's what this is made of, see? And that's why it's important for me to be part of an activist group, because I have people around me who are pushing me along, and I have people ahead of me who are pulling me along. You know, I have had some fantastic sponsors. After 2 years, Jim or Richard left, and he went back to California. And for about 2 years, I used the group. Now, if you want to commit suicide on an installment plan, that's a good idea. I mean, you always find somebody goofy enough in a group to agree with whatever crazy, insane idea you have. After just, you know, getting to the place where I'm trying to commit my suicide after 4 years of sobriety, I decided I better do something a little different. And that's when I met Jim, and I started asking Jim to be my sponsor. And God, what an experience that was. You know, I did a fifth step earlier with my other sponsor, But I did it on the back of a matchbook cover. You know, I didn't want nobody to catch it, you know. And I asked him, I said, well, why do we do this? And he says, well, he says, I'll tell you, John. He says, you can give it to me or you can give it to some preacher or priest or somebody. I wasn't going to give it to him. I mean, you don't want your sponsor knowing too much about what's going on in your life. So I gave it to a Presbyterian preacher. And I remember starting out this little matchbook thing I had and telling him about this stuff that I had done. And he says, wait a minute, is this going to take long? He says, I have a golf game I got to go to. Now I understand, but then I didn't, you know. And he says, is there much more of it? And I says, no, I guess that's about it. And for about 3 years, I thought I had done a fifth step. You know, I mean, I it's like I knew that I didn't, but I didn't want to question it. Because if I question it, I might have to really do one. You know, well, when I got Shaw to be my sponsor, there was no question. You know, he says, I'm going to be in Salt Lake City in about 3 weeks, and you will be there with an inventory. And I remember sitting down in a hotel room in Salt Lake City, and the two of us going over item by item about things in my life. I began to feel like I was more a part of Alcoholics Anonymous than ever before. About that time, I started a group called the Recovery Group in Billings, and it's my home group. And if you're ever in Billings, come see us. We meet just about every night of the week. Jim was instrumental in the design of that group, just as he is this group. He was a great example of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can just, I know what Jim would be saying to us tonight, because we're sitting there saying, you know, how, you was talking about how do you return the favor, and the way you return the favor is you do what we do. You carry the message to the next alcoholic. I mean, Richard was the same way. I'd ask him, you know, how can I thank you? He says, don't thank me. He says, make sure you're available for the new guy. You know, and the same thing with Dick, I mean, he's the same thing. You know, carry the message. All these people in my life who have been giants, if you will, who have been heroes, if you will, all those people have told me over and over again, the thing that you've got to do here is give it away. This is an altruistic movement. You give it away for fun and for free. And when you know, it's like love. The minute you give it away, you've got it. I used to think, well, if I'm going to love her, then I do something good for her, and maybe a year or two from now, when she finally gets over her insanity, she'll love me back. But that's not the way it works. When I'm kind to you, it comes back now. When I'm loving you, it comes back now. It happens right now. It's just like prayer. You know, I sit there and you pray over and over again for the same thing. God heard you the first time. You know, why would you pray over and over again? It's like a little kid going, Daddy, 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 Daddy. You know, my dad already knows what I need. You know, long before I ask, he already knows what I need. And, you know, I mean, what a gift to find out these little simple things. And people told me this when I was a kid. But with a mind like this, you ain't going to get that kind of stuff too fast. You know, it's like somebody's asking me today, how do you feel? Ask me in 6 months, I'll tell you. Because I really don't know yet. You know, I was here a year and a half, like I was saying. I was here in Alcoholics Anonymous a year and a half before one day it dawned on me in the middle of a meeting. I'm an alcoholic. It's like, don't call me lightning for nothing, you know. And it's amazing how I can live with myself and be a part of my life and not even know what I'm really doing until later on. Now, I don't want to sound disconnected, but that's the way I am, you know. I'm so easily offended, it just makes me embarrassed sometimes, you know. I was sitting there thinking tonight when they're calling on people to come up, well, how come I don't get called to come up, you know. I don't want you to think I'm not self-obsessed or anything, but, you know, it may not quite be that bad, but it's kind of almost that bad, you know. I mean, somebody was talking to me today about my home group, and I said, shoot, sometimes I walk into my own home group, and I don't feel like I'm a part of. And that's the disease of alcoholism. It's a crazy thing, you know. It's not about drinking. It's about living life sober. And somehow I get to do that. I get to do that one day at a time. Sheila asked me to tell a story before the meeting, and it's about Jim and sponsorship. And Jim had the ability to cut through the crap, and he sure did that with me. And I can remember one night I called him up, and I was just distraught because my life is upside down. And I began to tell this story this afternoon. I didn't finish it. He said, John, he says, I know what your problem is. You're an alcoholic. And then he gave me the solution. He says, what you do is tonight when you go to bed, you thank God for the night. And in the morning, you thank him for the morning and ask him to go with you through the day. Then you go to work. It's deep stuff. Go to work. And when you get through working, he says, you get ready and go to the meeting. He says, oh, and by the way, when you go to the meeting, you tell those people how good your day was. Well, that's a setup. I mean, I just got through telling them I was having a lousy damn day, and now I'm supposed to tell them how wonderful my day was. You know, so I go through this day trying to think of what I'm going to tell these mamby-pamby people in my home group about how good my day was, and all of a sudden I begin to have the day. I had a fantastic day just because I started looking for the good. You know, the day before I was looking for the bad. You know, as long as you look for it, it'll show up. You know, it's a funny thing about Cindy. I can sit there and look at all the bad things in Cindy, and she just gets worse and worse and worse. Or I can look at Cindy and start seeing all the good things in Cindy, and she gets shinier, shinier. Just amazing stuff. Just, well, how do you want to live? How do you want to live the rest of the day? You know, how do you want to live the rest of your life? You know, like this deal with cancer that I had, you know. What are you going to do? You're going to live in fear or you're going to live in faith? Do you believe in the power greater than yourself, or are you going to use your own willpower for a while? How's it feel? You know, my willpower feels like I'm killing myself, because I am. I live in total fear and isolation, or else I can live under the sunlight of the Spirit. How do you want to live? It's that simple. I mean, it's that simple. Now, don't get me wrong. Half the time I forget the deal, you know. So anyway, Jim's going to celebrate his 30th birthday. Clancy's coming over, and Hodges is coming over, and I forget the other two. There's two other people that came over for that party, for his birthday party. And Cindy and I had gone down to visit, and he was sick. He'd been sick for quite a while, and he sure looked bad. And Jim was a big guy, and he wasn't big no more. And he's sure tell that he's thinned down. And he'd sit over in the chair and just, you know, he's just like this, you know. And Benoit had kind of put his tie on, but it wasn't really straight or anything. And she'd put his shirt on, and he didn't have his coat on. And I remember him sitting there, and he was just kind of, you know, he'd talk and try to laugh, but it wasn't the same. And he looked out the window, and Clancy just drove up. And you could just see him pull his tie up. Just straightened up his shirt, throw his coat on. He got up straight, and he walked over. He says, my sponsor's here. And it meant something. And when he opened that door, from that time until we left several days later, he was a changed man. And it really comes down to, how do you want to live? You know, it's the same thing. How do you want to live? Do you want to live with the glass half full or half empty? Do you want to live a life of faith or a life of fear? You know, like Cindy said, this has been a weird year for us. I mean, I had a bout with prostate cancer earlier this year. 4 weeks ago, I had a mini heart attack. I had a stent put in my heart. I'm probably going to die after eating tonight's food. But at least I'll die with a smile on my face. I mean, you know, what a deal, you know, what a deal to be able to travel halfway across the country, to come here, to sit here with my friends, today to have breakfast with you, to, you know, some of you guys I spent last week with. What a gift for a guy who had no friends when I got here. I didn't have anybody that I could talk to. I had nobody that I could trust. I told my sponsor, Richard, I said, I can't trust anybody. He says, of course not. You know why? You can't trust yourself. And to be able to stand for something and be able to believe in what I believe in and be able to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in good standing and to be a friend of friends and try to be an example, you know, those are things that are priceless, you know, kind of like the credit card thing, but they're priceless, you know, to live a life beyond my wildest dreams, and that's what's happened to me coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is the most single important event in my entire life. There will be nothing that will come close to it, bar none, nothing. And it's because of people like you in rooms like this that this has been able to, you know, that I've been able to do this. And all I did was I just come to meetings. You know, a lot of times I kept my mouth shut. A lot of times I poured coffee when I didn't want to pour coffee. A lot of times I said yes to an AA request where it would be a lot easier just to say hell no. You know, a lot of times I showed up on a Wednesday night meeting because that's a required meeting at our group. And it's easier to show up than to listen to 90 people. Where was you last night? You know, those are the things that seem to keep a person like me in a place like this. So happy birthday. I want to wish you guys a happy birthday again, because this is important stuff that you folks are doing here. Every AA meeting is important. It's like, I like what Manoy says, it's like every light bulb attracts its own set of bugs. Okay? So this is the color of this light bulb, and I'm one of your bugs. Thanks.